It's another episode of Ken's Last Ever Radio Extravaganza by Kenzo. We're in the dwindling hours now of our coverage of the Republican National Convention here on WFMU's Elephant Stream. Tonight, the main event, the WFMU remix of the coronation of King George. There he is. There he is. Coming up next, Steve Krinsky doing a live hour of radio dedicated to the coronation of King George and other things. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Doug Shulkin will be interviewing Jesse Allen, one of the lead attorneys forcing Florida to release its voter rolls, its felon lists. See who they're disenfranchising in 2004. That's at 7 o'clock. And then at 8 o'clock, the main event begins when we remix the final night of the Republican National Convention at Madison Square Garden. But now, we move upstairs to Steve Krinsky. Steve, take it away.
Hello, Steve Krinsky here with a special Republican National Convention audio remix on the Texas Miracle. For the next hour, we're going to be talking to a bunch of Texans about the wonderful things that George W. Bush did as governor and how he and his associates have tried to export it to the rest of us. The Texas Miracle, they call it. Our guests, who we'll be talking to in a little while, are a seven-term representative to the Texas State Legislature, Elliot Neistat. Elliot was one of the killer D's, the 50 or so Democratic representatives who split, who left Texas a year ago and hid out in Ardmore, Oklahoma, in an attempt to prevent the Republicans from redistricting the state. We'll be talking to Elliot in a few minutes. And a little later in the show, we'll be talking to Glenn Smith. Glenn is a activist and author. He recently published a book called The Politics of Deceit, Saving Freedom and Democracy from Extinction. An interesting and clever look at Texas politics and its impact on the rest of us. Let me just start out for just a minute or so, and I'll fade Big Guitars from Texas out of here, with a little bit from the wonderful book by Molly Ivins and Lou DuBose called Bushwhacked. Between G.W. Bush's second legislative session in 1997 and the official beginning of his run for presidency in 1999, the state of Texas pissed away much of a $6 billion surplus. A surplus in Austin is like the 100-year flood in Amarillo. It comes about every 800 years. You want to make full use of everything you can get out of it. Governor Bush made good use of the surplus, at least for his own political purposes. In a state known for low taxes and no income tax, he gave a big chunk of the surplus back to the taxpayers. Then he ran for president saying, "I passed the largest tax break in the history of the state of Texas." And why not? The economy was booming. Enron stock was going to hit $100 and split. Streets were filled with trucks laying fiber optic cable. If you could get a table near the lean and hungry venture capitalists at the Mezzaluna restaurant in downtown Austin, you might hear one of them mention the next killer app. Then you could call your brokers. Sell Aguilon. Buy Tivoli. The boom was like Robert Earl Keane's "The Road Goes On Forever and the Party Never Ends." W. Bush arrived as governor after the party started. By the time it ended, he had ridden the Texas tech boom all the way to the White House. The first big Austin campaign bash in the summer of 1999 featured bad country music and a stump speech on Bushonomic blather. the largest tax cut in the history of Texas. Give tax dollars to the people who earn them. But the stock market tanked. The Supreme Court named Bush president. Tax revenues disappeared, and Texas went broke. As we write, this is a few years ago, Molly Ivins, Lou DuBose continue, we're looking at a $10 billion deficit in Texas, which will end up being $12 billion because our controllers always lie about deficits, or tell the truth in $500 million increments. It's raining in Texas. $6 or $7 billion in the Texas Rainy Day Fund would be right useful to legislators slashing programs in the state that's always a dead heat with Mississippi in last for government spending. Our casualty in the post-Bush budget crash in Texas is the state public schools. And they go on to talk about the impact on other areas of the state. Now, one of the things that has made the Texas miracle successful in Texas, and to some extent in the rest of the United States, basically cutting taxes, giving over power to corporations, cutting back social programs and government, has been political muscle, and that's some of what we'll talk about tonight. The political muscle I'm talking about played itself out a year ago when the Republicans tried to and eventually succeeded in redistricting the entire state simply as a way to get more clout in Congress. But a bunch of Texas Democrats, outnumbered in the State House of Representatives, tried to stop it by leaving and by preventing a quorum. Those Texas Democrats were called the Killer D's, and we're going to talk to one of them in a few minutes. Before we do that, we're going to hear a wonderful song from the Melancholy Ramblers called The Ballad of the Killer D's. We'll be back in a little while with Elliot Neistat, and we'll talk about it. In the meantime, the Melancholy Ramblers.
A man they called the Hammer in the year 2003 came to gerrymander Texas and take it for the GOP. He gave a map to the speaker, voters' districts it redrew. 7 years before the census, when new districts would be due. The bill snaked through the Capitol, no hope to block its way. Democrats were far outnumbered, they'd be crushed by Tom DeLay. There was panic and emoting, till a thought was passed around. The House could do no voting if no quorum could be found. In small groups they planned their getaway, and on Sunday they took flight. 47 brave lawmakers boarded buses in the night. They drove northward through the prairie, eating chicken that was fried, risking name and re-election for the honor of the ride. All the rangers, they pursued them, and the speaker tried to lure them. Come ye back across the river, home across that wide red river. Come ye back and make a quorum, but the killer D's ignore them. Tell the clock gave them a victory, they went down. Near the shores of Old Red River, in the state of Oklahoma, there's a town by name of Ardmore, 30 miles from the Texas border. Stands a diner known as Denny's, serving simple food yet hearty. Here the Democrats from Texas came to hide from the grand old party. Four other members joined them, another went to Mexico. That's 52 lawmakers, absentee and lying low. They called Homeland Security, the Hammer searched for clues. The race was on to find the fugitives and bring them back to make them lose. Willie Nelson sent them whiskey. Stand your ground, old Willie wrote them. While tornadoes raged through Ardmore and Republicans tried to smoke them. when their hideout was discovered, the story seemed to end. But the Oklahoma governor wouldn't turn those Texans in. All the rangers, they pursued them, and the speaker tried to woo them. Come ye back across the river, home across that wide red river. Come ye back and make a quorum, but the killer bees ignored them. Till the clock gave them a victory, they went down in Texas history. When the deadline for the bill passed, killer D's were on the road. Buses speeding through the starlight brought the Democrats back home. As they pulled up to the Capitol, cheering citizens awaited. Morning light spread over Austin, a power grab had been deflated. So whatever fate awaits them, they are legends now forever, in the news clips and the broadcast, in the books of the professors, in the bars and in the newsrooms, round the campfire's glowing embers, where the hacks and pundits gather, the killer D's will be remembered. All the rangers, they pursue them, and the speaker tried to woo them. Come you back across the river, home across that wide red river. Come ye back and make a quorum, but the killer D's ignored them. Till the clock gave them a victory, they went down in Texas history. All the rangers, they pursued them, and the speaker tried to woo them. Come ye back across the river, home across that wide red river.
Elliot, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, this is great to hear from you. I'm talking to Elliot Neistat, who's a seven-term representative from Austin, Texas, in the Texas House of Representatives. And we're going to talk a little bit about what I confess to be facetious, the Texas miracle. I gave a little introduction a few minutes ago, Elliot, about,
okay.
And I read from a little bit of Molly Ivins and Lou DuBose's Bushwhacked about some of the things that George W. did while he was governor and then later as president. But what you and I are going to talk about for a few minutes and what that song, that wonderful song was about, was this amazing adventure you had last spring, a year ago?
Yeah, it was a year ago on Mother's Day that we actually left.
And what was it about? Just let me let you just tell it from the beginning.
It was all about congressional redistricting, which, as just about everyone knows, happens every 10 years after the census. And every state in the country does congressional redistricting. And we in Texas did that also back in 2001. So we thought it was finished. But during the last session of the legislature, in 2003, a man named Tom DeLay, who's the House Majority Leader in the United States Congress, showed up in Austin and started walking through the halls telling people, I don't like the way the people voted in those new congressional districts, and since the Republicans are in complete control in Texas, we have an opportunity to go back and re-redistrict during the middle of the census. And we couldn't believe it, we meaning the Democrats.
And it's perfectly legal what he did?
Well, it's legal, but it's unprecedented. The only time there's ever been congressional redistricting in the middle of the decade is when there's been some legal problem and a court, either a state court or a federal court, has ordered a legislature to revisit and redo congressional redistricting. In this case, there was no court order. There was no outcry from the public. There was no reason to do it except Tom DeLay, in conjunction with our statewide Republican elected office holders, said, we can do it, we will do it, we want to create 5 or 6 congressional districts that guarantee Republicans will be elected.
So the state legislature gets the vote on this?
Yeah, the state legislature does redistricting for your state house, sometimes called the assembly, for your state senate, and for Congress.
So what were the numbers back then in terms of Republicans and Democrats in Texas?
Well, when we started in 2003, there were 88 Republicans in the House and 62 Democrats. And in the Senate, I believe it was 19 Republicans and 12 Democrats. And our governor, speaker, and lieutenant governor are all Republicans, as are every statewide elected official in the state. So Tom DeLay said we can do anything we want in Texas for the first time since Reconstruction and the Civil War. And he came down and said, I don't care if it's unprecedented. I don't care what every newspaper editorial is saying. I don't care if they call this a partisan power grab. We're going to do it because I can solidify the Republican majority in the United States Congress, in the House of Representatives, perhaps for decades, if we can pull this off in Texas.
What's interesting is it sounds too easy, that if you have a substantial majority in the state legislature that you can manipulate congressional redistricts and get away with it. And how come it doesn't happen in other places? Are they just sleazier there?
Well, you have to be in total control, and you also have to look at your state constitution. For example, there was an effort by Tom DeLay to do the same thing on a smaller scale in Colorado, where the Republicans are in control, and they did. They redistricted one congressional seat, one district, because DeLay said we can turn it around in Colorado. It was challenged, and the Colorado Supreme Court last year overturned it and said, no, you can't do it. And the reason was that the Colorado state constitution has language that basically says thou shalt redistrict only once a decade after the census is done. And many state constitutions have that language. We thought when the state Supreme Court in Colorado overturned the congressional redistricting plan in that state, we thought, wow, this is going to help us in Texas. But then we quickly realized we don't have that language in the Texas Constitution.
Right, right.
And so it didn't help us at all.
And there wasn't a sufficient public outcry from the newspapers and from, local leaders to stop this. It came right down to a few of you in the legislature?
Well, there wasn't a sufficient outcry because the leadership in Texas, the Republican leadership, didn't respond, didn't pay any attention. Every newspaper in the state, and I'm talking about more than simply the liberal Austin American Statesman, the Dallas Morning News, the Houston Chronicle, the San Antonio Express News, every newspaper said this is a pure partisan power grab. This is not what the people want. This is basically undoing democracy in Texas by undoing elections where the powers that be don't like the outcomes. Every editorial said, no, don't do this, and advised the legislature, do not take up congressional redistricting, especially when we had school finance to deal with, our state budget to deal with, insurance regulation to deal with. This just appeared at the top of the agenda when Tom DeLay came down and said, I want this taken up and you're going to do it.
So how did you eventually respond?
Well, we knew we didn't have the votes to stop it. We had been getting killed on everything throughout the session, especially with the Republicans cutting health funding, human services funding, housing funding, education funding, because we had a $10 billion shortfall. at the outset, and our statewide elected office holders said, we're not going to raise taxes and we're not going to institute any new taxes. That meant slashing Health and Human Services primarily, and that's what happened during the session. We lost on every single vote, and so when we knew that congressional redistricting was going to be on the agenda the day after Mother's Day, we decided we had to be creative and do something. And what we came up with was, to put it very simply, shutting down Texas government. And you can do that in the legislature. It's in the House rules that there must be a quorum. And one of us said, well, what if there's no quorum? Then they cannot conduct business in the legislature, and we can stop them from passing a bill because they will not be able to conduct business. But how do you break a quorum and not get caught? Because in Texas and in some other states, but I know in Texas, if you break a quorum, that is a big, big no-no. And the House rules say if a quorum is broken, the Speaker can entertain a motion to put a call on the House, issue arrest warrants, and send the Texas Rangers and the state troopers to apprehend, to arrest us, and bring us back to make a quorum, and they can use any means necessary.
And so the adventure began.
The adventure began when, after secretly organizing this in the Capitol, we were in session. We had to organize this quietly and in secret, but we were able to do that, and then we met at a predetermined place, the Embassy Suites Hotel in Austin, Texas, on Mother's Day in the evening, and we had two charter buses waiting, and we needed 51. There are 150 members in the House, so we needed 51 to break a quorum. When we boarded those buses heading out of town, because we knew we had to get out of state to make it that much more difficult for the Texas Rangers and the state troopers to track us down and arrest us, we picked, for a variety of reasons, Ardmore, Oklahoma. Ever hear of Ardmore, Oklahoma? I certainly had not. But when we left, we had 47. We had promises from three other Democratic House members that they would meet us in Ardmore. But we didn't know until they showed up the next morning whether we would actually have enough to break a quorum. And we did, and it was an amazing bus ride. We kept waiting for Texas Rangers or state troopers to pull us over or shoot out a tire on the bus. We didn't know. Anything they did would have been illegal because we hadn't broken the quorum yet. What came as a big surprise, and I still find this amazing when I talk about it, is that in addition to sending out the Texas Rangers and the state troopers, which we knew they would do, agents of the Department of Homeland Security, the federal government, were dispatched because Tom DeLay was so irate when he realized that we had not shown up, that we had broken a quorum, that he couldn't get his congressional redistricting bill through, that Tom DeLay, in conjunction with the Republican Speaker, Lieutenant Governor, and Governor of Texas, brought in the feds, the FAA, but more importantly, the Department of Homeland Security.
What was the logic to that?
The logic was that leadership knew that at least one of our members, the former Democratic Speaker of the House, flies places. He has his own plane. And they decided that the Federal Aviation Administration, in conjunction with the Department of Homeland Security, would be able to track down the plane and find out where we were. So they sent Department of Homeland Security agents. And think about it. That department, Homeland Security, was established to protect you and your family and your listeners and their families from terrorists. That's why we created the Department of Homeland Security at the federal level. Now we, meaning the 51 Democratic House members, were exactly that. We were duly elected state legislators from Texas who happened to be Democrats, And we didn't break any rules. We didn't break any laws. All we broke was a quorum, and they sent the Department of Homeland Security to track us down and bring us back. And what's even more scary than that, in my humble opinion, is that the 51 of us ended up at the Holiday Inn in Ardmore, Oklahoma. The Texas Rangers couldn't find us. The state troopers couldn't find us. The Department of Homeland Security couldn't find us. It took a Cub reporter from the Dallas Morning News who tracked us down.
What was the story? You told me a story about a bit of a wild goose chase. I don't know whether you guys set them on it or not, but they headed up to the Panhandle. They headed out to East Texas.
Well, somehow word got out that the 51 of us were hiding out on the ranch of a former Democratic member of the House in up near Texarkana, which is very far away from Austin, probably 600 miles. And so state troopers, Texas Rangers were all dispatched, an army, to this ranch near Texarkana to apprehend us. And guess what? We weren't there. And then somehow the Rangers and the troopers got word that we were hiding out at a ranch in deep West Texas, about 800 miles away. And we heard that the Rangers and the troopers and headed there to find us. And what a surprise when we weren't there. I do have a cute and true story. When the governor of Texas was trying to find out where we were so he could send the Texas Rangers and the troopers to arrest us, they knew, or they assumed by now, that we were out of state, but they didn't know where we'd gone. And so they were calling the governors of adjoining states, and the governor's executive assistant here in Austin was speaking with the Attorney General of New Mexico. And the conversation was, we just want to make sure, the governor wants to make sure here in Texas, that if these 51 Democratic House members ended up in New Mexico somewhere, that our Texas Rangers could go there with permission and execute their arrest warrants. And the Attorney General of New Mexico told the governor's executive assistant, well, we can't let you do that. We can't let your Texas Rangers execute their arrest warrants in the state of New Mexico. But I don't want you to worry. What I'm going to do is issue an all-points bulletin immediately, and we're going to tell all of our state troopers and law enforcement to be on the lookout for state legislators from Texas who care about health care for the poor and are against tax cuts for the wealthy.
That's a great story. That's pretty amazing. Now, this, you know, this is almost too funny to be true. It's like, never mind the Department of Homeland Security, just the idea that the Texas Rangers and the state police would be traveling all over looking for you guys under these conditions. It's quite amazing. How did it finally end? I understand when you went back to Austin, you got a pretty good welcome.
Well, what gets a little confusing is how it ended. We were in Ardmore for only 4.5 days, although we had to survive a tornado that came through, which shook us up quite a bit. Turns out Ardmore is in the heart of what's called Tornado Alley.
That was a Republican plot.
Exactly, exactly. We knew, we have a certain calendar, and there are certain deadlines that kick in. And we knew if we could stay in Ardmore, not get caught, not be brought back until, I think it was Thursday night, that the deadline would kick in, the clock would ring, and no bills can pass out of the Texas House of Representatives past that certain date. Mm-hmm. And so we knew if we could not get caught, not be brought back to make a quorum for those 4 or 5 days, any bill still in the House, including the House Congressional Redistricting Bill, would die. And that's what happened. So when midnight hit, we were back on those charter buses heading for Austin, and we had killed the bill, so we were heroes. Mind you, the eyes of the United States, not just Texas, were focused on Ardmore because this was, some people say, the first time in a couple of years that Democrats had stood tall on principle for the right thing, and we were actually defeating, taking on and defeating Tom DeLay in his partisan power grab. Willie Nelson was so excited by what we did, he sent two cases of whiskey, which came in handy. But we were getting faxes and emails and gift packages and care packages from all over. So when we returned to Austin, Texas, to the Capitol, having killed the bill, there were a couple of thousand people waiting, and yeah, we were heroes. And as your listeners know, some musicians decided to make a record called The Ballad of the Killer Dees. The problem is that the story, I wish the story ended there, but the Republican governor, the man in Texas who succeeded George Bush, the governor who Molly Ivins often characterizes as Governor Goodhair, Rick Perry, immediately upon the end of our regular session, called a special session. The governor can do that. So he called a 30-day special session to take up congressional redistricting. And there is some technical rules, which I'm not going to get into, which were upheld during that first special session by the lieutenant governor over in the Senate. And so they couldn't pass the congressional redistricting bill during that first special session. $1.7 million went down the drain. That's how much a special session costs, money which could have been used to restore all the cuts that the Republicans made in the Children's Health Insurance Program, for example. But the governor immediately called a second special session, and they changed some of the rules so that it looked like the Republicans would be able to get the bill on the floor and pass it out. And at that point, 11 Texas Democrats, members of the Texas Senate, said, "We're out of here." And they went to Albuquerque, New Mexico. And they stayed there for over a month and killed the redistricting bill during the second special session. By the way, we learned that, at least in Texas, members of the Senate are smarter than members of the House, because we 51 House members, we rode on charter buses, cramped, crowded buses in the middle of the night, 300 miles from Austin up to Ardmore, Oklahoma. We stayed in the Holiday Inn and we ate at the Denny's. The senators flew on corporate Lear jets, stayed at the nicest Marriott in New Mexico. They're smarter than we are.
Well,
except we actually killed the bill.
Yeah.
So in the end, one of those senators gave up. Sold out,
yeah,
and came back to Austin. The governor called a third special session, and finally they got the bill through. So we've been dealing with the aftermath of congressional redistricting ever since.
It's an amazing story and one that deserves more attention. Why don't we do this? As much as the story fascinates me, the more serious issues about George W. Bush and the Republicans and their strategies is what we ought to talk about. If you can hang on a few minutes, I'm going to play a little more of the song. We won't hear the whole thing. We'll get Glenn Smith on the phone, and we'll talk about what's going on now and some of the characters behind all this. So stick with us. I'm talking. My name's Steve Krinsky. You're listening to WFMU RNC Audio Remix. I'm talking to Elliot Neistat, a representative from the Texas legislature. And in a few minutes, we'll be talking to Glenn Smith. Stick with us. Here's the Ballad of the Killer Dees by the Melancholy Ramblers.
A man they called the Hammer in the year 2003 came to gerrymander Texas and take it for the GOP. He gave a map to the speaker, voters' districts it redrew. 7 years before the census, when new districts would be due. The bill snaked through the Capitol, no hope to block its way.
Democrats were far outnumbered. They'd be crushed by Tom DeLay. There was panic and emoting till a thought was passed around. The House could do no voting if no quorum could be found. In small groups they planned their getaway, and on Sunday they took flight. 47 brave lawmakers boarded buses in the night. They drove northward through the prairie, eating chicken that was fried, risking name and re-election for the honor of the ride. All the rangers, they pursued them, and the speaker tried to lose them. Come ye back across the river, home across that wide red river. Come ye back and make a quorum, but the killer knees ignored them. Till the clock gave them a victory, they went down in Texas history. Near the shores of Old Red River, in the state of Oklahoma, there's a town by name of Ardmore, 30 miles from the Texas border. Stands a diner known as Denny's, serving simple food yet hearty. Here the Democrats from Texas came to hide from the grand old party. Four other members joined them, another went to Mexico. That's 52 lawmakers, absentee and lying low. They called Homeland Security, the hammer searched for clues. The race was on to find the fugitives and bring them back to make them lose. Willie Nelson sent them whiskey. Stand your ground, old Willie wrote them, while tornadoes raged through Ardmore and Republicans tried to smoke them. When their hideout was discovered, the story seemed to end. But the Oklahoma governor wouldn't turn those Texans in. All the rangers, they pursued them.
Okay, I think we're back. Elliot, are you there?
Yeah.
Glenn, are you there?
I am.
Wow, two of you. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Let me just tell our listeners, we just had a nice chat with Elliot about the Killer D's, and I'm fading the song down. We're now joined by Glenn Smith. Glenn is a longtime Austin activist and the author of The Politics of Deceit, Saving Freedom and Democracy from Extinction. Put out, I'm having trouble telling what the publisher is here.
John Wiley.
John Wiley, okay. And one of the things we were talking about was the colorful story of the Killer D's, and to be honest, that's a fun story to tell, but the ultimate results were not so fun. How the sleazy manipulation that made redistricting happen, and of course the results of the redistricting, are much more serious. Glenn, where were you during all this? What's your take on the whole redistricting and what it says about Texas politics?
Well, I was here. In fact, I've wound up running MoveOn.org's national campaign opposed to the Texas redistricting, where we raised awareness of what Tom DeLay and his Republican cronies were up to around the country. I think Elliot is on the air with us here, was a part of that. And let me tell you, lots of people don't understand redistricting. There's a simple way of describing what the Republicans did under the guise of redistricting. They sat back mid-decade, years after the census, and decided, we want to represent these voters, and we want to disenfranchise these voters, and they drew a new map.
Yeah.
Boom, and they did it, giving themselves a handy majority and marginalizing progressive communities in Texas, people of color, and Democrats, and that's what they did. Simple as that.
What do you guys think it tells us about the current presidential campaign, the strategies of the Republicans? Is this typical?
Jelly, do you want to go first?
Well, I would say it is typical. If you look at Karl Rove's record and George Bush's record, and how they comport themselves in campaigns, whether we're talking about a race for the governorship in Texas, a race for the presidency of the United States, congressional races. It seems to me that they don't care about what the rules are, what the precedents are, and they'll basically use any means to go out and hammer people, I mean the voters, if they seem to not be complying with what they want, or they'll go out and hammer their opponents in political races. We saw that in relation to John McCain. We're seeing that now in relation to John Kerry. And there are two books out in addition to Glenn Smith's, which folks ought to be looking at if you want to understand how this happens. And they're both about Karl Rove. One is called Boy Genius, and the other is called Bush's Brain.
That's a movie now playing here in New York City.
Yeah, it's a documentary based on the book. And it's fascinating to understand how Karl Rove has, in essence, created this character, this president, this former governor of Texas, George Bush.
Glenn, how does this fit into your book, which is about presumably similar kinds of issues on a large scale?
I guess what I was trying to get at in the book and explore is how this high degree of manipulation and deceit are made possible by political practices that all of us take for granted. And so when you do step back from the process and take a look, that 75% to 80% of the information Americans get about politics comes from paid advertising, that participation in political groups, political parties, neighborhood groups, civic associations is not down by 10 or 20 people, but down by millions and millions of people since the 70s, you begin to see that there's this terrific gulf between the people and their daily lives and political candidates and office holders. And given that great distance, that gulf, it becomes really easy for those on the outside to be manipulated by those on the inside. And so deceit becomes a way of life in advertising and political communications, generally speaking.
Now, neither Karl Rove nor Tom DeLay are the sole problem by any means, but they represent something really ugly in the political process. Do either of you have any? Have you had dealings with them beyond this? Let me ask Elliot or Glenn the hammer. What's that all about? Tom DeLay, the hammer.
Well, that's his nickname, and there's a book that's coming out all about Tom DeLay called The Hammer. It should be in bookstores next month, and this is an individual who started out in the pesticide business as a bug terminator, and he didn't like all the regulations, the consumer protections, the rules that protect people from getting poisoned by pesticides and Terminex and stuff like that, and he ran for Congress so he could basically take on and do away with all these regulations in the environmental arena, and he is right wing and extremely power hungry, and perhaps on his way to being the next Speaker of the House, but he will resort to any means necessary to accomplish what he wants. In the case of congressional redistricting in Texas, he didn't care what anybody was saying, what the newspaper editorials were saying, what the lawyers were saying, what the people were saying. He wanted 5 or 6 more Republican votes in Congress, and nothing was going to stand in his way. And I think Karl Rove functions in the same fashion. Nothing will stay in Karl Rove's way if it's interfering with what he wants, which for the last 10 years or so has been moving George Bush up and up the ladder of political success, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there's an easy way of saying this. You know, of course, most Americans don't want to have to look this in the face or or think too hard about it, but here's just a pure fact. People like Tom DeLay, Karl Rove, and even George Bush simply believe their own power is more important to themselves and the country than our democratic institutions, and that is a fact. In other words, they believe that they're so good for themselves and for the country that it's worth sacrificing decades and centuries of legal precedent and the viability of other democratic institutions simply to enhance their own power. That is a different animal than we've ever seen in America before, really. I mean, in power. And I think it needs to be recognized for what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a good way to understand this, and a lot of people don't get this part of what happened in Texas, but I mentioned earlier that we had done congressional redistricting 2 years earlier. The map that had been produced was challenged, and it went up to the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court, which is the same court that anointed George Bush president, said the Texas Congressional Redistricting Act from 2001 is constitutional and complies with the Voting Rights Act. And the Republicans were in control back then, too. So they had drawn these maps, but while the voters in those five or six districts in Texas voted for George Bush and Governor Rick Perry and other Republicans, when it came time to vote for their member of Congress, they went back and voted for incumbent congressmen. You know, seniority plays a lot more of an important role in Congress than it does in state legislatures. So the people in those districts reelected incumbent Democrats. Tom DeLay came down and said, I want to redistrict. I want to redraw those lines to guarantee. I don't care what the people want in those districts. I want them redrawn so that it guarantees that only Republicans can get elected, and that's why when I've given these speeches and talks around the country about this, I always introduce it by saying this is about the undoing of democracy through the undoing of elections where the powers that be simply don't like the outcomes.
Elliot, are you up for re-election this fall?
Every 2 years.
So,
yes.
Is this going to cause problems for you, or are you okay in your
district?
No,
I'm fine. I live in the liberal oasis of Texas. Some people say the liberal oasis of the Southwest, and that's Austin, Texas. And I have a great supportive district, and I've only drawn a libertarian opponent this time, so I'll be fine.
But you're going to lose some colleagues in the process, I suspect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, again, as colorful and kind of interesting as Tom DeLay and Karl Rove are, Glenn, I assume that you would take a strong stand that the issue is not particularly the personalities, but rather the way power is distributed and particularly the role of corporations and others. I notice in your book you talk about some of these issues.
Well, certainly. I mean, I first of all probably couldn't agree that I found Tom DeLay and Karl Rove colorful. They remind me more sort of grim-faced gray bureaucrats getting what they want from behind the curtain. I mean, they're not
okay.
The most colorful personalities like we're used to in the grand history of Lyndon Johnson or Sam Rayburn or Garner and others from Texas that have been colorful in the past. These are, yeah, I would choose the chaos of colorful characters over the sort of grim, functioning, almost Eastern European-style, bureaucratically run system that we have today. I'll tell you another story that's very telling about this distance between voters and the candidates and office holders.
When Glenn, let me interrupt for a second. Talk a little more directly into your phone, please.
When Bush left Texas to become president, I had occasion to do opinion research throughout the state. Border to border, different kinds of people in different kinds of places, different socioeconomic backgrounds. And we, at the top of these groups, a focus group where we'd get 10 or 12 people at a time in a room and talk to them about what was on their mind, we'd say, what did you like about Bush? Now, these were Democrats and Republicans, all kinds of people. And to a person, they all said, we love his commitment to education. Well, then later, 30 or 45 minutes later, we'd return to the issues facing Texas, and we'd said, what's on your mind about the issues? And they all said, our education system's in the toilet. interesting thing was they didn't relate what they knew to be true in their own daily lives to what Bush had actually done.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave him credit for being for education when they knew very well in their own communities that education continued to decline in their own neighborhoods. That sort of dissociation from the facts of life is what I believe is the ultimate danger to democracy. And that's what, you know, the right wing has doesn't hesitate to exploit and take advantage of.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I know that some of the stuff that translates to the national arena, particularly in terms of having a president and a vice president who are both beholden, particularly to the oil industry, but also to corporations in general, raises real serious questions that hopefully all of us are paying attention to in this upcoming election time. Any comments on these issues and how it plays out in Texas and what those of us outside of Texas might be watching for?
Well, it's going to play out at the national level, which of course includes Texas. President Bush is going to run hard if and when he ever talks about domestic issues on passage of the Medicare RX prescription drug benefit bill. And anyone who has looked at this, including some of the most respected national organizations and advocacy groups like Families USA, are saying that the winners in this George Bush supported and bragged about Medicare RX bill are the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies, and that the low to moderate income Americans who are looking for relief are not going to get it, that it's basically a sham, that a very small percentage of elderly people will reap any benefits from this. But in the end, it's the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies that have come out more than smelling like a rose.
Right.
And yet, if George Bush decides he has to campaign in any way on a domestic agenda, he's going to play this as the savior for the elderly of America, that he was the only president who could finally push through an RX benefit, a prescription drug benefit in Medicare. And I know how the corporations, the big corporations, they'll say that's right. The question is, what will the media say?
All right. Well, if we can just put that issue on the table, we'd be moving in the right direction. Obviously, right now, as the Republicans wind down their political convention, they don't want to talk about that stuff, even on those terms. They want to just demonize John Kerry and talk in grand platitudes. How about some other issues that are at stake? How about the environment and the oil companies? You guys have a take on that one?
Well, I don't think there's any question that Bush has rolled back environmental regulations one by one in these first 4 years. I mean, another 4 years, there's no telling how far he'll go. I mean, he makes no secret of it. He's proud of it. And until the people rebel against him, he's going to continue doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, of course, in many cases, I mean, not every environmental question revolves around an oil company. But those that do, they're the great beneficiaries of it, and they turn around, and with the windfall they make, they give it to Bush and his patriots for election to other offices. I mean, it's really obvious to see. It's not a great secret to America. One thing that's disturbing about the messages they use, and Elliot mentions Medicare reform, you know, when they talk about those things, the people they're punishing aren't fooled. I mean, the elderly in America realize, even my own mom realizes, that it all got more complicated. The benefit itself was less than she had before. They're not fooled. But the Republicans are trying to deal with this little slice of the electorate in the middle called swing voters that, one, don't know because they're not recipients yet, and, two, only want to have their own consciences solved. So they hear Bush say, I'm doing something for the elderly, and prescription drugs, they believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't know that that's not the case. They just believe the spin of it. And those are the people we got to get more engaged to understand that Bush is lying.
Yeah. Now, a lot of people have been telling me about this book by Robert Bryce called Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. And the reason it keeps coming up is because apparently he articulates a kind of Texas model that we're talking about here. Do either of you know this book or
I know Robert and the book.
Uh-huh. What's the basic argument here that for those of us outside of Texas, we can kind of digest?
Well, they've sort of developed a self-reinforcing business to government network over the year. I mean, it's operated for years and years and years, really. It's nothing new. It's sort of shadowy, but most of its members are pretty prominent citizens. And it's a sort of informal but rigorously enforced state socialism for the rich is what it is. They get their own people into power. Those people then make decisions that benefit the folks back home. In the case of Texas, most of these companies were oil companies. So it's self-reinforcing. The companies do better, so their candidates do better, and they get office, and the companies do better. Mm-hmm. It's a vicious spiral,
Yeah. Either
up or down, depending on your perspective. It's very sophisticated. There's one other element that I think we can see more visibly this election cycle than most. They are relentless, and they punish their opponents, either in the private or the public sector. If you do not play their game or you threaten to blow the whistle, you're ruined. And it happens over and over again. There's a story in Salon today about an early Bush employee and consultant named Jimmy Allison, the late Jimmy Allison. His wife finally told the story. And once he was thrown out of the Bush circle, I mean, he was really thrown out of the Bush circle. It was so bad that she's finally come forward and told some of the stories she knows of Bush's very notorious days in Alabama.
So you can find that on the web at Salon?
It's on there today, yeah.
Is that salon.com?
Salon.com, a story by Mary Jacoby. It's really interesting reading. And one of the stories, Linda Allison, that's the widow of Jimmy, this former George H.W. Bush consultant, is one of the stories she tells is that George H.W. called Jimmy and said, "You've got to get my son George out of Texas. He's raising hell and causing trouble. Can you take him over to that campaign in Alabama?" So Jimmy said yes, and of course George W., mid-20s carouser, showed up late to work when he showed up, left early if he'd been there, mm-hmm. was supposed to be going to the National Guard, never showed up for the Guard, and she tells the story of coming out of the headquarters one night, and there was Bush in the parking lot urinating on a car. Later on, he got into a shot match with police officers and tore up the house he was staying in.
Wow.
You don't hear much about that these days, do you?
No.
Yeah, by the way, Robert Bryce, in his book, and I've read excerpts, discusses the cronyism in relation to Bush family friendships that go back to deals involving the Saudis and the Bin Ladens. There are these amazing connections that go all the way back, and these friendships are fostered and maintained.
Let me interrupt. I just got a note from our station manager said we can go an extra few minutes, and if you guys can stick with me for a few more minutes, that'd be great. What I think we should do at this point is I have one more question. Then I want to talk about what can people do, because I know Glenn in particular, you're really active with Move On, and I looked at the Drive Democracy website today, so I want to hear about that. But before we do that, I keep hearing about this investigation that Ronnie Earle, the district attorney, is working on. Anything happening with that?
We're waiting. We are waiting to see if the indictments are handed down. What the district attorney in Austin is doing, and this is per legislation that created a public integrity unit. The legislature did that. He is investigating whether there was improper and illegal use of corporate money that was channeled into the races of 20 House members so that the Republicans could get a majority of the House in Texas for the first time since Reconstruction. And the Texas Association of Business was intimately involved in channeling this money allegedly illegal into the races of House members, hundreds of thousands of dollars. The Republicans won, took control of the House, elected a Republican speaker for the first time since the Civil War, and the rest is is history.
Right.
The problem is that while we're waiting to see if the indictments come down, and Tom DeLay is also in the mix here, we're afraid that the Republican-controlled government in Texas will decide, gee, we don't want this Democrat, Ronnie Earle, the district attorney of Austin, to have this public integrity unit in his shop, and that next session they're going to simply remove it from the district attorney of Travis County in Austin and stick it in with the office of the Republican Attorney General of Texas. So
yeah,
we're concerned about this type of retaliation.
Yeah, that's the old chicken in the hen house one, huh?
But it could happen. These indictments could come down, and if that happens, how does Tom DeLay react? How does the Speaker of the Texas House react legally and politically to being indicted on very serious charges of ethics and campaign irregularities?
Let's switch to the, and of course I meant Wolf in the hen house, but let's switch to the what can people do? Maybe, Glenn, you want to start it off and tell us a little about some of the stuff you're involved in?
Well, sure. You know, when I was writing a book, and the most interesting piece of research I came across showed that political participation depended upon a person's self-confidence as a citizen. If they were confident enough to speak out loud to a friend or colleague or coworker or neighbor on a political opinion, they were much, much more likely to vote. And so this idea of the citizen confidence is something we've got to work on. Organizations like Move On, by providing a new two-way kind of communication where people can express their opinions either by signing petitions or making contributions, or just giving creative ideas, writing their own blogs. All those things are ways people can speak up. By multiplying the ways people can speak up, we've increased citizen confidence and hence political participation. So it's really a simple matter to encourage people to get more and more involved in the process. You know, the country and the world thinks of Texas as a Republican citadel. Here's a funny thing about Texas. If we just succeeded in getting about a 10 to 25% better turnout from Democratic or progressive voters, we would have every statewide office in the state. In other words, there's more Democrats in Texas by a long shot than there are Republicans. But because of the lack of participation, Republicans are able to win with a significant minority of the voters. And so what I do, every way I can, the organization DriveDemocracy.org, its whole mission is to not only encourage people to get involved online, but for those online activists to get out of their homes and offices and go encourage others who may not be online to get involved politically. All we've got to do is, take 10 or 15 minutes a day and talk to our fellow citizens, and things could begin turning around. So it doesn't take that big a revolution or new constitutional convention. It just takes the citizens to rise up and get involved.
And tell us, what's Drive Democracy?
Well, actually, DriveDemocracy.org grew from the anti-redistricting campaign, from the Killer D's and the senators who wound up also having to flee the state later on. Move On had run a national campaign. We raised money from Americans in every state, and we had a little bit of money left over. And it was decided to use that money and invest it into an organization that would provide ongoing benefits. So DriveDemocracy.org is here in Texas focusing or trying to focus on state and local issues, but primarily trying to get people involved in politics here and to get them to then go work on their friends and neighbors and other or people they know in other states.
So why don't you tell us the websites. At this point, the website you'd recommend people check out is DriveDemocracy.org.
DriveDemocracy.org, by the way, we're just in the middle of a terrific campaign where we're raising money for a bunch of Texas entertainers like Marsha Ball and Natalie Maines, writers like William Broyles and Sarah Bird, singers like Jimmy Dale Gilmore and mm-hmm. Joe Ely, others are trying to raise money so they can place an ad nationally to let the nation and the world know that there's a lot of us here whom George Bush doesn't speak for.
Terrific. So we can find out more about that at drivedemocracy.org.
And
right?
right there on the middle of that is a picture of the book cover of Politics of Deceit. And if you click on that, you can buy a handy copy.
That's great. And can people also get in touch with you that way if they're interested?
Absolutely. They can just, there's a link right to my email box right on that page.
Great. Well, that's great. Thank you, Glenn. And we'll cross our fingers that your hard work will pay off. And hopefully all of us will do that as well. Elliot, any thoughts on what people can do other than getting out to vote and campaigning and so forth?
Well, I want all your listeners to know that what Glenn is doing and others is working. We had a handful of Democratic sellouts who jumped on board when the Republicans took control and supported the Republican speaker and voted with the Republicans. We went after them during Democratic primaries and knocked off four or five of them, with the help of organizations like Move On and Drive Democracy, and that it can really work. Mm-hmm. Organizing at the grassroots and then plugging in through these websites and what Glenn is doing, that it works. And it's forcing some of the other sellouts on the Republican side and the Democratic side to think, gee, maybe I do have to pay attention to what my constituents, what my district really needs, and not just vote lockstep with Tom DeLay and the Republican leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing some changes in Texas, and we're certainly hopeful that we'll see a major change at the national level so people like Glenn and me can be there when George Bush comes home to Crawford, Texas. We'd like to welcome him back.
Sounds good to me. Well, thank you both very much. We've been talking with Elliot Nashtad, who's a seventh term. Am I right, Elliot? Seven?
Yeah.
Running for his eighth term in the Texas State Legislature. And he's a popular Democrat from Austin. And thanks so much for talking to us. Glenn Smith, author of, maybe you should give people the title of the book instead of me garbling it. Why don't you do
got it right. It's The Politics of Deceit, Saving Freedom and Democracy from Extinction.
Thank you very much, Glenn, and we'll look forward to, I'll be in touch with both you guys, and thanks so much for talking with us.
You're
no,
very
I really
welcome.
Enjoyed it. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, take care. I'm Steve Krinsky. This is the WFMU RNC Audio Remix, and we've got a couple more minutes. The next show's going to start about 10 after, so I got three quick songs of Texas musicians singing about these kinds of things. Start off with Steve Earle. I'll catch you next time.
Jim and John Army, cause you had no place to go. There ain't nobody higher right here since I'm jumping down to Mexico. Reckon that learning self-trade made me see the world. Moved to the city someday. Somebody somewhere had another plan. Now he's got a rifle in his hand, rolling in a bag and wondering how he got this far. Just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war. Bobby had an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue to the bone when landing Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. A stack of overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now and he's still there, chasing ghosts in thin dry air. Meanwhile back at home, the finance company took his car. just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
Refrigeration's out, the power's out, and they'd just be happy to fix you up. This is just in off the wire. Allied troops have, I repeat, have broke out of the Normandy beachheads. So let's say a prayer for our young men and women who are in harm's way over there and out on them islands. Ask the Maker to send as many of them home as he can spare. Well, anyway, that's the world, but here on KAND in Corsicana, it's Fair to Midland, and we got a new one by Cigarette Miller and the Rhodes Scholars in the good old USA.
I could tell the moment that I saw him, he was nothing but the troublemaking kind. His hair was much too long, and his motley group of friends had nothing but rebellion on their mind. He's rejected the establishment completely, and I know for sure he's never held a job. He just goes from town to town, stirring up the young folks till they're nothing but a disrespectful mob. And I know for sure he's never joined the army, served his country like we all have done. He'd rather wear his sandals and his flowers while others wage the war that must be won. They arrested him last week and found him guilty and sentenced him to die, but that's no great loss. Friday they will take him to a place called Calvary and hang that troublemaker to a cross.